Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Between the Tackles. The 2025 season is in the books. We now enter the long-awaited 6 months till football training camp starts again. I know we got a lot in the offseason to get to, you know, over the next few months. But today's going to be reserved for breaking down Super Bowl 60. I'm here with Manish. How are you today, man?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? That's probably the more important question.
You know, I always give myself when the Patriots lose 24 hours to kind of, you know, process, get over it, you know, whatever, however you want to put it. I didn't need that long in this one, probably because the game seemed like it was over from the start. We'll get into that. But, you know, this season for the Patriots was so unexpected. You know, nobody expected them to make a deep run in the playoffs and everything like that. So as a fan of the team, it was a very, very exciting, enjoyable story with the 2025 Patriots. So I'm in a good place mentally right now.
I'm glad to hear it. I wasn't sure as the game was unfolding. But yeah, look, it was, you know, an overachieving season by the Patriots. But I think if you got Mike Vrabel in a room and asked him privately how he feels, while I'm sure he's exceedingly happy for the strides that he made in his first season in New England and the success that Drake May had in his second year as a pro. You know, Mike Vrabel understands how difficult it is to get to this point, and there is no guarantee that you know, this Patriot group will get there next year or at any point over the next several years, because it is so difficult. And when you get to this point, you know, just talking to players and coaches over the years, none who played for the Jets, but other coaches and players throughout the league, it is so painful losing a Super Bowl. And yeah, it was 29-13, but even when it was 9-0 at halftime, I think you and I communicated, and I just did not believe that this Patriot offense could do anything against Seattle's defense. You saw it that entire first half, 51 total yards for New England, was the third worst in the history of the Super Bowl. They only averaged 2.2 yards per play, never got any kind of rhythm going. We'll get into the details of why that was the case, but by and large, except for, you know, a lightning quick 7-second drive late in the game and then a garbage time touchdown, they really were spinning their wheels the entire game. And all the credit really goes to Mike McDonald and that defense, which essentially obliterated Drake May and Josh McDaniels' offense on the biggest stage.
Yeah, I mean, from the get-go, it was a brutal watch for me as a Patriots fan watching that offense. You know, we'll get into the first thing that I really want to get into when breaking down this game is the Patriots have a real problem on the offensive line. It was really exposed in this game, but for the large part, the entire playoff run when they went against, you know, we get into the whole schedule thing, but when they went against these top four defense, they had a really difficult path through the Super Bowl defensively for their offense to go against them. You know, facing the quarterbacks they did, that's another story. But defensively, this Patriots team had one of the most difficult runs to a Super Bowl, you know, in a long time, if ever, with the caliber of teams that they were playing. But I think in this game specifically, you really saw the significant issues they have with that left side of the line with Will Campbell. You know, Jared Wilson, I don't even believe he's naturally a guard. I believe he's a center. So I think in the future, you're going to see him move to center on that offensive line. But they have a real problem with the fourth overall pick. He is not a left tackle. He was getting schooled in this game, no matter who the Seattle Seahawks put up against him. He allowed, I think NetGen stats came out with it, it was 14 pressures, the most of any offensive lineman in any game this season. So across all of the 32 teams, across all the teams that they played in the playoffs, across all positions along that offensive line, it was the most amount of pressures allowed this season, which is a major problem for the Patriots, who spent a fourth overall draft pick on. So they're going to need to address that this offseason. They had no answers. Drake May, you know, he was not good in this game. I'm not going to sit here and really defend how he played, because he had his share of misses, but it was clear right from the start that he was hurried up. He was not comfortable, and you know, six sacks. You know, there's not much. I think it was six. The seventh one was that interception. But for all intents and purposes, it was a sack. You know, just it's not good enough. I think he was sacked 21 times in the postseason. It was the most in NFL history for a quarterback getting sacked in a playoff run. That's not a recipe for disaster. So I think in this game, you know, for all the good that the Patriots did this season, the lack of talent offensively around Drake May showed up.
Yeah. Look, I think Drake May is the only quarterback in NFL history to be sacked at least five times in four consecutive playoff games. So the offensive line is a big problem. Will Campbell is a massive problem. And Mike Vrabel's, he's no dummy. He put Campbell out at left tackle. I think anyone who's objective about this understands that he's not a left tackle. He may not be a tackle at all at the next level. They may have to slide him into guard. But, you know, I sometimes caution about pressure statistics because there is a level of subjectivity. And I know that Next Gen, as you said, Burge, gave Campbell 14 pressures. That to me seems exceedingly high. I know he was very bad on Super Sunday, but 14 pressures would be essentially a third or 30%, I should say, of Drake May's dropbacks. I think he had 48 dropbacks. 14 of 48 seems like a really high number. I mean, maybe it's accurate. The bottom line is that if anyone watched this game, they know that Campbell was terrible. I thought it was very disappointing as well that Campbell did not speak to the media after the game. He's a professional now. I know it's tough, you know, when you play poorly on the biggest stage, but we've had quarterbacks, much more high-profile players, play poorly on the biggest stage and then still have some accountability afterwards. So I just thought that was an unfortunate choice by him. Hopefully he grows and develops, but I think from a X's and O's in football standpoint, he's obviously not a left guard, a left tackle. I don't believe he's a right tackle as well. I think he'll be best suited moving into guard. Sliding inside would probably help him out a lot. I think ultimately that's what the Patriots are going to do because they just can't afford to have him out there every single week. Like, he's not going to give up 14 pressures or whatever every game, but he was clearly a turnstile, and that was the difference. And you're right, Drake May did not play well. You know, three turnovers. Even when he had opportunities, he missed them. Now, there were a couple opportunities where I thought maybe, you know, Josh Booty dropped the ball that was catchable, but then there were poor passes. You know, early in the game, a pass that maybe Hunter Henry should have caught that still was an off-target type of pass. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, even late when you felt like it's over, it was 19-7. And I believe it was in the fourth quarter. The Patriots were back inside their 10 or 15 yard line. First down, Drake May had all day. And there was a defensive breakdown. I believe it was Austin Hooper got behind the defense. Wide open. And there was a similar play earlier in the game where Sam Darnold was under pressure and missed an open JSN. But on this play, there was no pressure and May just overthrew Hooper. Who knows? I mean, they probably would not have won the game anyway. But it was clearly not, to be honest, either quarterback's finest hour. But, you know, I thought, you know, when we get into a little bit more detail, you know, I thought that, as I've said for weeks, that the Patriots had lived a charmed life. No need to apologize for winning these games. But ultimately, you had a sense that unless Sam Darnold pulled a page out of C.J. Stroud's playbook and completely imploded that the Seahawks were going to win this game because that's how great their defense has been all season, and that's how great they played in the biggest game of the season.
Yeah, and, you know, with the Patriots, I struggle to understand what Josh McDaniels in that offense had as a game plan going into this, just because the offense was so putrid in the first half. It was really hard to see what they were actually trying to do against this, you know, elite Seattle defense. You know, there was didn't seem like there was any creativity. There was, you know, they went away from the run really early before the game got out of hand. They went away. I think Stevenson only had 7 carries in this one. You know, one of the plays that really stands out to me, I think it was, I want to say it was in the late first quarter or early second quarter. They had 3rd and 5. Yeah. And they were in Seattle territory. and they call up a draw play. And I'm like, you have a guy who missed the MVP by one vote. Yes, they did not look great, but at some point you got to trust you got to just go in with it, right? And you run a draw play that gets stuffed at the line of scrimmage. Like, to me, I'm crediting Seattle's defense a lot. I was not on this team much at all this season. You were. I slept on them all year. Their defense, I always didn't have them up there in the likes of Denver or Houston. I don't know if that's East Coast AFC bias coming out or what have you, but this Seattle defense is an incredible unit. And, you know, I tip the cap to Mike McDonald and how that defense played in this one, because the Patriots had zero answers for anything. They looked completely inept. And I come back to the offensive line. Like, again, I get Drake May was not good in this game, was sped up. You know, I don't know if he's more hurt than the team let on, you know, talking about getting his shoulder shot up before the game. Drake May didn't make any excuses about that, but I don't know if he's more hurt than the entire league basically, you know, what was on to in these 2 weeks leading up to the Super Bowl. But he was rattled from the start in this one. And I don't know if that's just taking the toll of all the hits that he was taking in the three previous games that could have played a part in it, where it was in his head early because he knew he was going to get hit and he didn't want to make the mistake. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the Patriots talent level, I think, is what ultimately did them in. I expect them to go heavy offensively this year with how they spend their money in the draft. You know, before we move on to Seattle, I just want to talk about the Patriots defense, because last week we were on here and I was saying Christian Gonzalez is going to have a game, or the Patriots may not want him or anything like that. If the Patriots ended up pulling off the win in that game, he was their MVP. He was the main reason that game stayed close. He made a couple of fantastic pass breakups in this game. He was unbelievable, and it was a shame that him and then the rest of the defensive unit, who, you know, aside from Kenneth Walker, really neutralized JSN, Rashid Shaheed, they were not able to get anything going in the passing game in this one. Only two drives over 50 yards. I mean, the Patriots defense really showed up to play. And at the end of the day, they were a better unit than I thought they were.
Yeah, they played. I thought they played okay. I'm not going to throw bouquets at them. They gave up 6 scoring drives out of 13 that Seattle had. So this wasn't some kind of historic performance. It was good enough to win, you would think, you know, given that they didn't, give up 35 points or anything to that degree. But the bottom line is that, you know, Kenneth Walker had 94 yards in the first half. That's the most in a half in the history of the Super Bowl. So it's not as if the Patriots were stout. They made Darnold look very uncomfortable. They did a great job against the pass, as you said. And Christian Gonzalez, I thought, had an incredible game with two or three awesome pass breakups. But that's only one half of defense. You have to stop the run. And you know, all we heard for a couple of weeks were how stout they were when Milton Williams is in the game. And all that was true during the regular season. But you can't allow a running back to rush for essentially 100 yards in the first half of a Super Bowl. That's awful. So while I thought that the defense played good enough to win, I don't think it was some sort of exceptional performance. In comparison to the Patriots offense, it was incredible. But by and large, you know, they had, you know, their hand in this loss as well. Clearly, it was mainly because of the offensive deficiencies, but you can't let an opponent run all over you in the Super Bowl. And that's, you know, frankly, what happened in this first half.
I'm sorry, if it's 12-0, if they've given up 12 points at the start of the fourth quarter, you're doing your job. They didn't allow any significant scoring drives. I mean, I'm sure, yes, they got run over. The Patriots defense was very clear where they were not going to let JSN and Rashid Shaheed beat him. They were going to make Kenneth Walker beat him. The two drives, longer drives that they gave up, not on short fields because of the turnovers on the offense, they held them to 3 points. At the end of the day, you know, that's a good enough defense to end up getting a victory there. And
they gave him 22 points. I mean, that's, to me, you should in the NFL win games where your defense gives up 22 points. It's fine. 22 points is fine, but 22 points is not some sort of airtight defense. They gave up 22 points. I mean, if you watch football, you understand you should probably win games where you give up 22 points, But you can't really pat anybody on the back because he gave up 22 points. Like I said, it's good. It's nothing special.
I'll push back and say that, you know, 10 of those points were in garbage time. 10 of those points were really in garbage time. And they were on short fields that the Patriots offense gifted them. That's where their touchdown to Barner came, was off the end. I think it was off the fumble from Drake May, where the game kind of blew open at that point. I mean, the only touchdown they gave up was a short field. And after playing how long? How many snaps were they playing? I mean, Seattle dominated the time of the possession in this game. Patriots were consistently going three and out.
Yeah, it was fine. But again, at the end of the day, when you look at how many drives the defense faced and how many times the opponent scored, even though they did a nice job tightening up in the red zone, if you're giving up 6 scoring drives out of 13, what does that tell you?
I mean, 6 points, they're all field goals. There was one touchdown.
Right, and those field goals mattered, right?
Well, the field goals definitely matter, yes, but like, if you're going to ask your defense to do that, like, I'm not sitting here saying that the Patriots defense is on the level of Seattle. Obviously I'd be ignorant if I said that, right? That's completely not where I'm going with this. The Patriots defense did what they needed to do in this game to win, and that was to hold them to field goals. And credit to Mike McDonald for not taking the cheese of Ben Johnson and all these other Yahoo head coaches for going for it on fourth down in the big game. He proved that method of take the points was worth it. When you only give up 2 drives of significance in this game, and those result in 6 points, the rest of them were shorter fields. We're talking 30 yards, 20 yards. Only 2 drives were over 50 yards in this one.
So they gave up scoring drives of 51, 55, 69. That's 3 scoring drives totaling. There was a 3 of the first scoring drives. Look, they get credit for tightening up in the red zone. But you know what where they would get a lot of credit? If they didn't actually give up points, which is what Seattle did. And that's why Seattle is the champion and the Patriots are not.
First drive, 51 yards. Great. That was the first drive of the game. Patriots buckled down. Great. 3 and out. 6 plays, 10 yards. Then the other 50-yard drive. 8 plays, 55 yards. You hold them to a field goal. 29 yards. Then they give up the 69-yard first drive of the second half, field goal, 3 points.
Right, but
punt.
But you can't discount that they're giving up points because that's how you win. You give up points.
I understand that, Machine. The point that I'm making is that those drives were the only drives of significance from the Seattle Seahawks, and they all resulted in 9 points. They resulted in 9 points. The touchdown drive that they scored was a 37-yard drive after a fumble. Literally had to go, you had the ball at the 37 for the Patriots.
That's kind of how football goes, right? I mean, 2 weeks
earlier. I understand that.
Right, but at the end of the day, I think that you have to be fair about this. And while they tightened up when it mattered within the course of a drive, the reality is that they gave up the yardage to put Seattle in field goal range, whether it was a shorter field or a longer field. They gave up 22 points, which again is good enough to win a game. So they deserve credit for playing well enough to win. They did not play poorly. I'd be disingenuous if I thought that they played poorly. But the notion that a team that gives up 22 points and 6 scoring drives deserves any sort of special recognition, to me, I disagree with that.
I'll agree to disagree with you on it, because I thought that they were fantastic in this game. And yes, they made Kenneth Walker beat them. My opinion, Kenneth Walker wasn't even the MVP of this game.
Well, I do.
Wasn't
I think
Kenneth Walker wasn't even the MVP. It was Jason Myers and Dickinson, the punter.
Okay. I would say that.
Those two guys were the MVP.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that a kicker whose longest field goal is 41 yards is the MVP. I think it was clearly Walker. Well, to me, it was clearly Walker because that running game was why the offense got in position to score. It wasn't Sam Darnold. You know, Sam Darnold had a nice touchdown to Barner, to make it 19-0. But by and large, the reason that Seattle was getting in those positions to kick field goals because Kenneth Walker was carving up the Patriots. I mean, he averaged on 27 carries. When you average 5 yards a carry on that many carries with so many explosive plays, how many times did he have over 10 yards? 4 or 5 times? I mean, he had some big chunk yards. Yeah, I mean, I think on back-to-back plays, he had like 29 and 30 yards.
It was like one drive where he had two big runs.
Right, but then he also had several 10-plus yard runs. And again, just look at the body of work, 27 for 135. Giving up 5 yards a carry on that many carries tells you that you did not play well against the run. It's not as if he had 5 carries averaging 5 yards a carry. He had 27 carries and averaging 5 yards a carry. So all that being said, they lost not because of their defense. They lost because the quarterback did not play well. The offensive line did not play well. Nobody helped out the quarterback with any kind of play, through the air. I thought Josh McDaniels, frankly, gave maybe too much respect for Seattle. Seattle's an unbelievable defense, but I thought he was a little bit too conservative. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you have a legitimate MVP caliber player at quarterback, not taking shots. And I'll give Clint Kubiak credit, even though their pass offense wasn't particularly good as well. There were shots that he allowed Darnold to make, and Darnold did not hit on them. He misfired on them, and sometimes it was Christian Gonzalez making an incredible play, and sometimes it was Darnold underthrowing or overthrowing players. But the offensive coordinator at least gave the quarterback an opportunity. I understand the predicament that McDaniels was in, because in order to take deep shots, you have time. To have protection, right? And that's where things just never really fell into place in this game. I'd be very curious, we'll talk about it in the offseason, how the Patriots address the offensive line. Now, they certainly need better weapons. And, I think I'm virtually certain that there'll be an aggressive play to trade for A.J. Brown. Whether or not anything happens, who knows? But you can bet that the New England Patriots will reach out to the Philadelphia Eagles to see if A.J. Brown's available, and if so, what the price would be, because that would be a player that could immensely help out this offense and Drake May in his third season. But again, we can get into details of that later. The bottom line is, look, Seattle's a better team all season mm-hmm. long. They're a dominant defense. They had a dominant run game all season, and even though they were missing one half of that backfield, Kenneth Walker ultimately did them in. And look, from an entertainment perspective, I thought it was a boring game. Yeah, I mean,
it was really very boring.
Yeah, I'm not, I know that Patriots fans, Seahawks fans are fully invested in this game. Every snap matters. The most memorable plays, honestly, for me, were the plays that were missed, whether it was, a Darnold missed overthrow, underthrow, or, a Drake May fumble interception. It was things that didn't go right for the offense that kind of stick out in my mind, because there weren't really any dynamic plays other than a few runs by Kenneth Walker that I thought were special.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, there was not a single play to me that stands out where it's like this won the game. Like it just wasn't there. When Drake May and Josh McDaniels, circling back to that, let him air the ball out, they had that quick hit touchdown, right? Like they were
coming. Right,
those
yeah,
those
yeah.
are those are two of the, those two throws, one to Mac Hollins, one actually both to Mac Hollins, the 30-yard to Mac Hollins and then the touchdown, were the two best throws by any quarterback in that game. And
yeah, the touchdown was great. I mean, it's a great play.
It got to the point where it's like, it's me sitting here as a Patriots fan, I'm like, all right, they got a shot now. It's only a 2-score game. They forced Seattle 3-and-out. It's like, okay, here we go. And they're driving, and then who the hell knows what Drake May was looking at on that throw, that interception. That interception sealed the fate at that point.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're trying to make a play at that point.
Hero ball.
Time is not your friend here. It's not your ally. So you press. You see things that might not be there and make decisions that you probably wouldn't have made in the first half.
It wasn't the time. They weren't in desperation mode at that point yet. There was still like 10 minutes left in that game.
Right, but there's a sense based on how the first 3.5 quarters have gone that, hey, you know what? Like this team, I got to make something happen, because clearly we haven't been able to really move the ball through conventional means. So I don't fault Drake May for the mistakes he had in the fourth quarter, even though technically the game was still within grasp. I just thought that, he didn't play well in the first three quarters. I mean, I think that was more, even though he wasn't turning the ball over early, I just thought that he just wasn't sharp. I mean, for whatever reason, it's first game, first Super Bowl for both quarterbacks. I mean, I think I mentioned to you during the game, I thought that Darnold looked nervous. he didn't have his sharpest game, and clearly, May didn't either. It was just the what we had talked about in the preview episode. The reason that the Seattle defense is so good is that, they'll have some timely blitzes, and they did, and they really cashed in the Super Bowl. But by and large, they're a team that brings four-man pressure. That's why they were bottom five in the NFL in blitz percentage, and they make it happen with four-man pressure. That's why they were in the top five of pressure percentage this year and pressure rate, and that's exactly how things played out. The defensive line of Seattle just completely swallowed up New England's offensive line, and I don't know if the Patriots had 3 or 4 weeks to prepare, if things would have been different, just because the talent disparity in the trenches was so significant. And that's where the game was won and lost. I mean, it's not glitzy. It, it doesn't grab that many headlines, but the guys up front, Lawrence, Murphy, Leonard Williams. I mean, those are the reasons why the Seattle Seahawks are champions and the Patriots are not.
That's 100%. We said it last week that the game was going to be decided by the trenches, the Patriots offensive line versus Seattle's defensive line. And at the end of the day, it's what did my Patriots in. Hats off. Great season. It was fun. But I'm looking forward to the offseason. We're going to be talking a lot about the combine. We're going to be talking a lot about the draft and free agency. You got any final thoughts on this before we just touch on the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I do want to touch on the executives in this game, and one executive who was not in this game, but was probably on the top of mind for one particular fan base. John Schneider has done just an unbelievable job. He's the first general manager in NFL history to win two Super Bowls with the same team, with two different head coaches, and an entire roster completely different from the first Super Bowl that he won. He's been to three Super Bowls. He lost one of those Super Bowls because of Malcolm Butler and Daryl Bevel's decision to pass at the one-yard line. But to me, the job that John Schneider has done in a decade or so in Seattle has been unbelievable. To me, he will one day be in Canton as a Hall of Famer. Just the thought of rebuilding a team where it's two completely different entities and bringing home a Lombardi Trophy for both teams is just remarkable work by one of the most intelligent, savvy general managers in the NFL today and of all time. I mean, this is a guy who learned from Ron Wolf as a scout in Green Bay. Patriot fans obviously know who Ron Wolf is. He's Elliot Wolf's father. I just have so much respect for Schneider, and I have for such a long time. Not only a great person, but just an unbelievable builder of teams. And I just thought that that to me is worth mentioning, because he will go to Canton. He will be a Hall of Famer at some point. And maybe better days ahead for Elliot Wolf. But there is one general manager who has been mentioned over the last several weeks, and clearly now is back into the spotlight, and that's the former Jets general manager, Joe Douglas. By every objective measure, was one of the probably five worst general managers in NFL history, even prior to the Super Bowl. When you look at winning percentage of guys who had been general managers for at least five seasons, Matt Millen had been the undisputed king of being the worst general manager in the history of the sport. But I think it's pretty clear that Sam Darnold winning the Super Bowl yesterday really punctuates that not only was Joe Douglas the worst general manager in the history of the Jets franchise, but now he is in the conversation clearly as being the worst general manager in the history of the NFL when you consider not only his inept record. I believe he had a 31% winning percentage, which again is bottom five of all GMs who have been in that position for at least five seasons. But because he traded away a then 23-year-old top three pick quarterback without really trying to help him and support him in any way by bolstering the offensive line or giving him real skill position players, and then watching that guy ultimately become a Super Bowl champion while the guy he replaced him with became a bust, obviously. I think that really punctuates Joe Douglas's career as the worst general manager, not only in Jets history, but arguably now the worst general manager in the history of the NFL. And quite frankly, he is, the, in my estimation, the worst of the worst, really a masterclass of slop. And to be truthful, you know, no amount of leaking information to reporters would change that reality. So, you know, then and now, you know, as a member of the Jets and now as a member of the Philadelphia Eagles, you can leak information to the media as much as you want to provide a little bit of cover, but the numbers and the reality, you know, they can't be erased. And then also factor in that Leonard Williams was a second team All-Pro and a Pro Bowler, also a top six pick by the New York Jets, another blue chip player that Joe Douglas inherited and ultimately traded away. So he traded away two top six picks that that he inherited, and both of those guys became Pro Bowlers and ultimately Super Bowl champions.
Yeah, it's really hard to not feel that way. I mean, Leonard Williams was a beast in this game. Jason Myers, they let him go. They didn't bring him back.
Yeah, that predated Joe Douglas, so he doesn't get the scarlet letter for that one. But yeah, not a great night for the Jets. Or it's funny because I'm sure Jet fans were very happy that the Patriots did not win, so they could find some solace in that. But on the flip side, there's a quarterback who, by the way, is in his prime. Sam Darnold is in his prime, and he is a Super Bowl champion for another team. So that certainly has got to sting the Jet organization. You know, again, a litany of missteps and mistakes and ineptitude, and it was really highlighted on the biggest stage on Sunday.
Absolutely. Before we close out this episode, I just want to hit on the Hall of Fame class of 2026, which was announced, I believe it was Thursday night. Drew Brees, Roger Craig, Larry Fitzgerald, Luke Kuechly, and Adam Vinatieri were inducted into the Hall of Fame. No Robert Kraft, no Bill Belichick, no Torrey Holt, no Reggie Wayne, you name it. You know, I have a real problem, and I think the Hall of Fame is going to address the whole voting process after what transpired this year. But with guys like Robert Kraft and Bill Belichick, again, I'm biased, sitting on the outside looking in and seeing that, you know, three spots were not filled based on, you know, the percentages and the voting and everything like that. It spurns me. It's like, I don't know. They got to revamp the process. I don't want to take anything away from the guys that got in, because all of them, you know, are deserving of being in the Hall of Fame. So it's hard for, I'm not going to sit here and kind of trash on that. But the process itself has got to change. You know, there's been a lot of comments, you know, during the Super Bowl about the process. Good for Rodney Harrison for calling out Tony Dungy on not revealing his vote. You know, guys like Randy Moss and all these guys, you know, have comments. What are your thoughts, Manish?
Yeah, look, I'm not a Patriots fan, as you know. I thought it was laughable when the news first came out that Bill Belichick wasn't going to get in. I think it's just as laughable that Robert Kraft didn't get in. I mean, these guys are the best owners, the best owner and head coach of this generation. You can make a viable case that Robert Kraft is the best owner in the Super Bowl era. He's got a little bit of competition, but he's in the conversation. I don't think there's any doubt that Bill Belichick is the best head coach in the Super Bowl era. I thought, frankly, that it was cowardly for Tony Dungy not to reveal his vote. When he was asked before the class was announced, he said that he thought it was inappropriate to give his thoughts on who he voted for until after the class was announced, intimating that he would, in fact, reveal who he actually voted for after the class was announced. And he did not. And I think it's Bush League. And I think, you know, anyone with half a brain can understand and see that he did not vote for Bill Belichick. Yeah. I don't know about Robert Kraft. He probably didn't vote for Robert Kraft as well. And I think it's personal. I think there's a lot of jealousy there because of the just the dominant way that the Patriots handled his Indianapolis Colts. I think it's unfortunate. You know, I don't know Tony Dungy personally. You know, he seems like he's an upstanding guy, but in this particular instance, it was clear to me that he let his personal feelings about Bill Belichick, Robert Kraft, and the Patriots influence his vote. And as you said, good for Rodney Harrison. You know, Rodney Harrison didn't hide behind a keyboard and tweet at Tony Dungy and say that, you know, he was wrong and they got it wrong as a group, and do things in any kind of passive aggressive way. He was standing right beside Tony Dungy and as part of the Super Bowl pregame, and he told him what he, you know, what he felt and what I think any objective NFL fan would feel. That this is Bush League. It's BS, and there's really no room for that in voting. And I'm not someone who says, you know, you should be stripped of your vote because you didn't vote for somebody that I agree with. But I just think in this particular case, it's so abundantly clear to me that there's a bias. And if you're not going to take people off the committee, that's fine. But there's got to be more than 52 people or however many people there are. I do agree with Randy Moss and Deion Sanders in this sense only. Players and coaches should be involved in the process. I believe that Hall of Fame players should be involved in the process. I also believe that former general managers and former head coaches should have a vote. Now, how you determine which general managers, coaches, and former Hall of Fame players are involved is another question. I don't know how you determine which guys in that bucket you would get involved, but clearly, even if you ramp up the voter pool from 50 something to 100, I think that would help dilute some of these outlier choices and choices that, again, perhaps influenced by personal distaste for candidates. But something definitely needs to change. I don't like the structure of 15 modern day candidates being in one bucket and then former coaches, owners, and senior candidates being in a separate 5-person bucket. I think that's a flawed structure. Mm-hmm. As well. It needs to be revamped. And frankly, I think it's a joke that Bill Belichick didn't get in, but in many ways, this could end up being a blessing in disguise if there's actual real change. If things don't change in a year from now, they've got the same voting structure with the same people voting, then this would have all gone to waste. But hopefully, you know, this ridiculousness sparks some kind of tangible change in the voting process.
Yeah, I agree 100% on involving the players, Hall of Fame players, the coaches, the general managers, diluting that pool a bit. But I do agree that media members need to be a part of the process too.
Sure.
Because they are major. They cover the league year round. They're as involved as the players as everybody else. But there needs to be more of a balance. And I think if they could strike that balance, it would be fantastic. And I think, talking about, you know, the senior owner, coach, contributor bucket, splitting that up in some way to, you know, allow the coaches to have more opportunity, the owners and the senior players to have it. So coming up with a new method for that is the way to go, because it's clearly flawed, and I'm hoping that this, like you, ends up making a big change. So
it's ridiculous. I'm sorry to cut you off here. It's just the notion that like Phil Jackson wouldn't be a first time Hall of Famer. That's what we're talking about with Bill Belichick. I mean, think about how ludicrous this is. You know, we're a couple weeks or a week or so out here, right? And so, you know, people have weighed in. I still think it's unbelievable. Like, just thinking about it, like Bill Belichick didn't get into the Hall of Fame.
On his first go, that gets more Super Bowl titles than any head coach.
How is it that not every single voter voted for him? I mean, he should have not only been a first ballot Hall of Famer, he should have been a unanimous first ballot Hall of Famer. It's just, I don't know. It's maddening, but you know, we're talking about sports, so in the grand scheme of things, it's not that important. But it's laughable. I cannot believe that. And the same goes for Robert Kraft in my mind. How many Super Bowls does this guy have to go to and win in order to get into the Hall of Fame? I don't know. I just, you know what? Like I said, I'm not a Patriots fan. I just think it's just ridiculous. And to like explain it away by saying, well, you know, these other guys, it might've been their last opportunity. That's not what the Hall of Fame
is. Spygate and all this stuff.
Well,
like,
I don't care about Spygate. I mean, when we had Peter King on recently, he said, look, Spygate, He paid his penance. The Patriots paid their penance. He was punished for that. But if you're going to punish Belichick, Kraft, anyone involved in the organization, obviously Brady as well. If you're going to punish these guys for Spygate in year one of their eligibility, what's going to change in year two? I mean, Spygate still happened. So are you never going to vote for Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft and potentially Tom Brady? It's ludicrous. Those guys, you know, they obviously crossed the line. They obviously paid a price, but you move on. They won Super Bowls after that. So I just think it's so ridiculous to hold Spygate against Bill Belichick being a first ballot Hall of Famer. The guy was a first ballot Hall of Famer, whether or not Spygate happened, and he proved it before Spygate. He proved it after Spygate. It's petty. It's personal. And there's really no place for that when you're trying to objectively evaluate the people who have been involved in the NFL.
I totally agree. We'll see what happens. But yeah, that's the closing episode of Between the Tackles for the 2025 regular season. It's been an awesome season of this show. Looking forward to getting into it with you, Manish, this offseason. With all the activities, all the NFL calendar starting to fill up here over the next couple of months with the draft, combine, free agency, and all that. So, been awesome. Looking forward to the future, Manish. We'll catch you next time.